been doing every Sunday morning is have a theme session. Our theme this summer is Worship with All the Saints. We do the saints as the days come along, and we've been doing things on worship all year or all summer long, some of them, most of them, on Sunday morning. The reason for our theme is obviously, of course, the New Lutheran Book of Worship. And I have tried to point out each week that that what we have in the Lutheran Book of Worship is in many ways a charter for reform and renewal in the Church, and not just a cosmetic treatment of the service book and hymnal. I am continually disappointed to hear reports, as I do, of congregations that have simply replaced the musical portions of LBW with the musical portions of service book and hymnal with LBW, and continue to conduct their services really according to the structure of the rite in the service book and hymnal, and might as well have saved themselves the money at that, because the thinking behind the Lutheran Book of Worship really is thinking in that calls for rethinking of the whole nature of the Christian Church as it expresses itself in its rituals. One of the things that's happening, at least, is that the Reformation itself is in many ways coming to expression for the first time in Lutheran service books in LBW. It sounds strange to say that, but a lot of the things that Luther had hoped for in the Reformation never came to ritual expression. In Luther's own liturgical constructions, for example, he calls for a freestanding altar table that is set out into the congregation, and that the presiding minister stands behind this altar table facing the congregation. Up until very recently, most Lutheran churches were not built in that way at all. In Germany, if you go there, you will find that that many of the ancient medieval altars are now almost art pieces in the east wall of the church, and there is a separate table that just has been placed there for purposes of the celebration. But in this country, at least, Lutheran churches were rarely built with altars as Luther wanted them to be done. That's one of the things that now is an attempt at incorporation in LBW. The services of the service book and hymnal made it seem as if the service basically ends with the sermon, the offertory, a closing hymn, and the benediction, or the benediction and a closing hymn. Then, if you want, you may also go on with the Lord's Supper. LBW has reversed that. It assumes that the normal celebration of the congregation on Sunday will be the Lord's Supper, and if you insist, if you really insist, you can skip about 13 or 14 pages and conclude with a prayer and a benediction. But the LBW makes quite clear that the offering belongs essentially to the celebration of the meal. The offertory begins that part of the service, which includes the meal. Well, all right, anyway, what I'm trying to say is that that Lutheran Book of Worship is not merely an attempt at sort of cosmetic improvement, that is, giving us slightly better music or an improved text and wording. It really attempts to have us think through fundamentally what the Church is, and to recover Reformation accents as well as to give ritual expression to some of the new insights into the nature and mission of the Church that we have been receiving in the last generation or two. The main thing that I want to call attention to this morning in the liturgy generally is the designation of the pastor. There is a letter called P in the service of Holy Communion. Let's take a look at that. On page 57, you notice that there are small letters at the beginning of each of the parts of the liturgy. Under rubric 5, you see the letter P, and then the response C, then A. A stands for assisting minister. P does not stand for pastor. It stands for presiding minister. The significance of the term presiding minister is, I think, one of the most far-reaching aspects of the LBW, because what it is trying to say is that the service is not something performed by the pastor to which the congregation is, in some sense at least, the spectator. And then you can go home afterwards and say, well, how did you like it this morning? Well, he didn't do too well today, we are apt to say, or the pastor did very well today, or wasn't the minister nice today, or I enjoyed your service, is what people say as they're walking out the door shaking hands. One of the things that LBW makes possible is the elimination of this handshaking ritual at the end of the service. The congregation gathers before the service, and greetings are really to be exchanged at that point. The service ends very abruptly, as this morning the Matins does, you know. It ends, go in peace, serve the Lord. The congregation says thanks to God, and then everybody leaves. The point is to go from the altar into the world, not to have a sort of farewell ritual at the door. So you can avoid all that, I enjoyed your service this morning. But people really do often think that it is the minister's service to which they come. Like the concert last night, it's really appropriate to say to the musicians, I enjoyed the concert that you performed. We were the audience. We were, in fact, spectators. We may have encouraged them with our applause, but we were spectators. The liturgy is not that. The liturgy is the work of the people. It is the ritual work of the people that symbolizes and signals the functioning, the being of the people out in the world. So what we are doing in the liturgies is, in a sense, a nutshell version of our lives. We say radical things in the liturgy. We say in the offertory prayer, for example, we offer with joy and thanksgiving what you have first given us, ourselves, our time, our possessions, signs of your gracious love. Receive them. Receive ourselves, our time, our possessions for the sake of him who offered himself. Or, at the top of 68, we offer ourselves to your service and dedicate our lives to the care and redemption of all that you have made. We are saying radical things here. We are saying that these words are to be life-shaping actions and rituals. So the term presiding minister means the congregation has gathered for its work of ministry, and the pastor presides over the ministry of the congregation, its ministry in ritual and its ministry in servanthood in the world. In other words, what we are really suggesting here is not that the pastor is chaplain to a group of families who happen to be able to afford him and who can therefore call on him for religious services at appropriate points in their lives. You do the baptizing now, pastor, and you do the marrying and you do the burying. But the notion behind this is that the ministry belongs to the people, and the pastor is the president of a congregation, a group of people already in ministry to each other. Now, that comes, I think, to special expression in the so-called occasions. marriage and burial are, for example, two of the occasional services that we have here. The again, think of the notion behind this. The notion behind this is not that the pastor does the marrying and the burying, but that the congregation is somehow engaged in a ministry here. In the marriage ritual, for example, every Christian tradition recognizes that the essential ministers of the marriage rite are not priests or pastors at all, but that the priests in the marriage rite are the bride and the groom. It is never a pastor who marries a couple. It is always the couple who marry each other. They do so in the presence of at least one other person who is the chief witness to that marriage, namely the presiding minister. But the couple marries each other. They are the priests in this particular liturgy. This means, therefore, then, that the designation presiding minister is especially appropriate for the marriage ceremony. Let me make one other comment at this point, too. The congregation that assembles for the marriage ritual is invited to participate in the marriage ritual, at least in the prayers and the hymns and whatever else is done. What the couple is doing when they marry each other in the church instead of in, let's say, a judge's chamber or in the home of a justice of the peace, what they are doing when they marry in the church is in one sense no different from what takes place in a judge's chamber. In other words, all you are doing is substituting a judge or a justice of the peace or some other legal officer as the chief witness of the thing that the couple is doing in marrying each other. But when you ask the church to be present by inviting either a clergy person alone or more preferably a congregation to gather, you are inviting now the blessing of God on a ministry, that is the ministry of your marriage to each other. And how does God bless a couple? He does not bless a couple with zapping them from on high. He blesses a couple through the ministry of all of the people who assemble to help them stay married to each other. It would be awfully interesting to read Luther's Traubüchlein, his little booklet on marriage, in which he proposes a rite and so on. He says, in marriage we enter into great perils and difficulties and dangers, and therefore we need the support and the blessing and the community of the congregation to sustain and support this marriage in all of its difficulties and temptations and assaults and trials and whatever else. He pictures all of this very vividly. Well, 50 years ago we might have read Luther and laughed. Today nobody laughs when you talk about all of the terrors and perils and difficulties and assaults into which marriage enters. Gail Sheehy tells us in passages that some at some point in every marriage, couples really do make another decision beyond the one to marry, and that is to stay married. She thinks it happens within the first 7 years, that 7 years is kind of the make or break point, and that most of the marriages that break within those first 7 years. So when we are asking a congregation to gather, we are literally asking for the blessing of God through the ministry of all of the people who assemble there. That means, of course, probably as the first line of ministry, the ministry of the family. But it certainly means as a second line of ministry, the ministry of the congregation in which we have gathered. Now, what I'm about to say, I mean, all that is lovely theory, and I'm going to try to make some application of it right now. And what I have to say is very much vision. That is, I'm looking ahead. I'm trying to say what could be and perhaps even what ought to be. I'm definitely not saying what is. For what is really a problem. That is, the customs and the practices that have grown up around the marriage service are customs and practices begged, borrowed, or stolen from all kinds of sources which have little relation to what I have just now said. First of all, the presiding minister for the contemporary American marriage is usually not the pastor at all, but the bride's mother. And because marriage is primarily a social occasion put on by the family of the bride. I mean, I'm not exaggerating here, I hope. It's a social occasion put on by the family of the bride. The congregation that gathers has little resemblance whatsoever to sustaining this couple in its marriage. It is really a social gathering of the friends of the bride's parents, the groom's parents, and the bride and the groom. Sometimes you may even get the friends of the bride and the groom there. Mostly it's the bride's parents and the groom's parents who get invited. Guest lists are drawn up and so on. Many of the other customs date from a curious collection of sources. The custom of the father of the bride giving the bride away goes back to the Old Testament, where daughters were the property of the father and become the property of the husband in marriage. That's the origin behind this. It has entered very late into Lutheran liturgical practice. Most Lutheran weddings, even when I was a boy yet, didn't have any giving away of bride by the bride's father. The bride usually marched down the aisle alone in the church's marriage services that I remember as a boy. Now suddenly, in an age of equal rights amendment, we have fathers giving brides to husbands, going back to an ancient property notion of the bride. Let me just not advocate reform right now. Let me just say where this comes from. In addition to that, most of the clothing that we wear at weddings comes from upper class English society. The notion, of course, in English society was that there were particular kinds of clothing that one wore at particular hours of the day. So there is morning wear, a morning coat, and late afternoon clothing and evening clothing. Morning clothing is the cutaway, right? The gray striped trousers, the black cutaway with the long... it's long in the back and it just gets cut away, and you wear a gray tie with a gray vest. These are the kinds of clothes that English upper class wear at morning racing events and morning teas and morning flower shows and morning receptions by the Queen. In the afternoon, one wears a tuxedo. In the late afternoon, one wears a tuxedo with bow tie, and in the evening, and black striped down, black trousers, and in the evening one wears white tie and tails, the kind of clothes that symphony orchestra people still wear when they play, with a white vest and a white tie, and then the tails down the back. Now, this is English upper class and nobility, custom of the nobility. It doesn't occur on the continent. If you go to Germany, formal wear in Germany, this was so nice when I was a student there, formal wear in Germany, for men at least, is simply a black suit with a rather festive tie, usually a silver-colored tie. All that I had to do to be formally attired in Germany was simply to wear the same clergy suit that I wore when I was... wearing a clergy shirt, and buy myself one of these sort of silver-colored ties, little stripe in it, and I was perfectly attired formally for any occasion that I wanted to go to in Germany. We went to the Bayreuth Wagner Festival operas one summer when I was there, And every day the newspapers would announce all the royalty and nobility and everybody else that was arriving for these. We were sleeping in a hayloft and eating out of our van because that was all we could afford at Bayreuth. But we could mingle with anybody. It looked just like anybody else formally attired because on the continent, people do not dress formally as they do in England. But we have taken these English upper-class formal wear customs and translated them, you see, into what is appropriate at weddings. I don't know where this comes from, but it's one of the things that bothers me more than anything else about American wedding customs. So Genghis and all the other formal wear outfits make a mint at every wedding, renting us clothes that we will never wear again, and that really are saying to us, we want to ape the English upper classes. We do the same thing with wedding dresses and bride's dresses and bridesmaids' dresses that make it virtually impossible for the bride and the bridesmaids to sit down. The result is that weddings are usually stand-up affairs. You can never be a part of the congregation in all this paraphernalia with trains and whatnot all. Again, this comes from court life. It does not come from Christian life at all. It is the one day, of course, when one can look like a queen, I suppose. But my gosh, we're not queens in the social sense. We may be theologically, but we are certainly not in the social sense. And veiling came again out of the ancient Middle East, where women were veiled to everyone but their husband, you see. And so to wear this veil and to have it removed at a certain point in the ceremony again comes out of a custom and a tradition which has little to do with our own time or a Christian understanding of marriage. Now, what can you do about all of this? Well, first of all, you can rail against it, as I'm doing right here, which does me an awful lot of good. I feel as if I'm spitting into a 60-mile-an-hour gale. Not much is going to come of all of this, except that I keep hoping once in a while that maybe somewhere some seed is planted, some vision awakened, and we can say to ourselves, why in the world do we let ourselves be dominated by these kinds of traditions and customs and visions that come from such alien and I think really bad sources? I don't want to imitate English upper class life. I have no interest in that at all. I don't know why anybody should. And it's time, in a sense, for us to think through again what we are really doing in marriage. Well, let's turn to the marriage service and see whether there are some alternatives given to us in LBW. The marriage rite is on page 202. Oh, yes. Anybody need a book? We've got a lot. Anybody else? Books? Okay, page 202. If I were going to start from scratch with marriage, the first thing I would want to say is that the ritual is the tip of the iceberg. The ritual is the tip of the iceberg. What is going on involves all kinds of stuff that has gone before the ritual and many other things that will flow as a consequence of the ritual, so that the ritual brings to focus a lifetime of involvement. The preparation for marriage does not consist primarily in guest lists and so on. The preparation for marriage consists in working with in a couple who have fallen in love and who want to marry, working with friends and family and counselor who may or may not be the clergy person, a counselor to help them, first of all, test their decision to marry. one of the good things that can happen is that through some intelligent counsel for marriage, an engagement is broken. That's a wise decision if a lot of people say it really doesn't look as if it's going to work for you. One of my closest friends was engaged to a girl, and wisely the two of them went to some to a professional marriage counselor and spent some weeks in counseling and conversation, and the evidence seemed to be almost incontrovertible that they were going to have a very, very unhappy go of it if they went through with the marriage. And they broke their engagement, and it wasn't an easy thing to do, but I think that they were probably wise in doing so. That's one of the things that happens if you are willing, at least, to test your own decision in the context of a larger community of family and friends, and above all of some good counsel. One of the things that seminary does now is to try to train clergy in marriage counseling, but you don't have to go to a clergyman for that. There are professional marriage counselors today who would much rather invest themselves in trying to assess the prospects of a marriage than in trying to put one together that is virtually on the edge of breaking up. So much goes into the preparation. The congregation that one wants to assemble then ought not to be, in the first place, people to whom one has social obligations, but really ought to be a congregation designed to assist in the support of that marriage. As I said, I think the first line of that includes family, but it may then well include also a gathering of people where one resides. I don't know whether the marriage then ought to take place in the home of the bride and groom, but that certainly wouldn't be a bad place to start. One of the problems that we have with our contemporary mobility is that frequently children are living in places far removed from their parents, so they go back home to a parish, a congregation that they may have left years before, simply because, again, the bride's mother is the presiding minister, and of course it's easier for her to preside over this whole occasion if it can be in the proximity of her own home and church. But that isn't saying anything about the support for that marriage. The support for the marriage may therefore come from an entirely different community. One of the more radical solutions that I can think of is don't have the wedding in your mother's home church. Have it in your home church if you are now living away from home. Let your parents come to visit you there. And that's one of the ways of avoiding having the bride's mother be the presiding minister. Another solution, however, would be to make sure that the congregation that is assembled for the wedding is a congregation that includes at least some people who will be part of the support community in the new home of the bride and the groom. That would be, I think, another solution. Now, the second thing is that the marriage service, as we have it here, page 202, offers us two possibilities. The one possibility is that the service stands by itself without the celebration of the Holy Communion, in which case everything on page 202 is an abbreviated form of the service of the Word. All right? An abbreviated form of the service of the Word. What you have in the marriage service then is an entrance rite that involves a procession. The procession should not be the bride coming in, let's say, on the arm of her father to be given away to the groom. The procession should be the procession of all of the people who are involved in the wedding. I don't again know where the superstition came from that the husband should not look on the face of the wife until the time of the service. I know a lot of wonderful marriages in which they have seen each other all day on the day of the wedding. So it seems to me that the procession, the entrance rite into the church, should include bride and groom, any attendants who are really witnesses, and above all, the parents of the bride and the groom should be in the procession. There are good ways of arranging this. The clergy can be part of the procession too. If the clergy are a part of the procession, the presiding minister is last in the procession, just before him, the bride and the groom, and or they may march in with their parents, the bride with her parents, the groom with his parents, and sit on opposite sides of the congregation as they come in until the time for the ceremony, and then bride and groom and parents and whoever present themselves at the altar. And sit on opposite sides of the congregation as they come in until the time for the ceremony, and then bride and groom and parents and whoever present themselves at the altar. I'll say some more about that, the reason for that in a moment. But the entrance rite, the procession, includes all of the people. You don't have to have grooms nervously pacing some back room behind the altar, and the bride wondering whether he made it to the church on time. You just get together. The people who are going to be the ministers participate in the procession together. Then what we have is an abbreviated service of the word, which begins with a greeting and a prayer. Remember, in the service of the Holy Communion, the service of the word, the entrance rite can omit all of those canticles that we sing and the Kyrie, the prayer, Lord, that ends with the congregation singing, Lord, have mercy. All that can be omitted. All you need is the greeting and the collect, and that's all you have here, greeting and collect. Then everybody sits, including brides and bridesmaids in all of their unsittable in finery. It just simply says, sit. I keep looking at Terry there sewing away at her wedding dress, and I hope I'm not undercutting everything that you're doing. Pardon?
Everything you're saying is real supportive of
her. All right, all right. But at any rate, one might look at the wedding ritual before you buy or make your dress to see whether you have one you can sit in, you know. Because now comes the lessons and a sermon or an address. A hymn may also be sung, so that now you have the abbreviated service of the word. Then the bride and the groom and at least parents, bride and groom and at least parents present themselves before the minister on the top of 203, and he now has a very brief introduction, very brief. The Lord, because you have already, you see, had lessons and address and hymn, so you don't need now a long rehearsal of all kinds of things. You can just simply say what the occasion is. John and Jean have, if it is your intention to share with each other joys and sorrows and all that the years will bring with your promises, bind yourselves to each other as husband and wife. And and they stand and face each other and join hands. Now, the service is very, very simple, because all we are really doing, all that really constitutes the marriage, comes now in rubric 3, 4, and 5, where you stand, face each other. You're not facing the minister. You're not saying your vows to the minister. You are saying them to each other. There are, in the Brown Minister's Desk edition, alternative vows. Examples of other forms of promises are on page 36 in this Brown book. Or you may write your own and say them to each other. Then you exchange rings. I give you this ring as a sign of love and faithfulness. And the bride and groom then join hands, and the minister announces their marriage. See, notice what he is doing. They have married each other. And what the minister does at this point now is to say, John and Jean, by their promises before God and the presence of this congregation, have bound themselves to one another as husband and wife, to which the congregation responds, blessed be the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And the pastor then says, those whom God has joined together, let no one put asunder. Now comes the congregation.
The tradition of the rings.
It's not optional either, is it? The rings?
No, no. Out of what tradition? I don't know. That's a good question, and I don't know.
It's very Christian.
May exchange rings, but it isn't.
Here again, I think probably simplicity is the order. Simple rings and an exchange would be probably the best thing. But the congregation sits then at the point of six, and the bride and groom kneel for the blessings. They do not kneel for the prayers, they kneel for the blessing. And the blessing is pronounced, first of all, by the pastor who lays, or the presiding minister, who lays his hands on each in turn, or both together, or some of each while he says this. You need an assisting minister, or an acolyte, or someone to hold the book for you at this point, so that the presiding minister's hands are free. And then in 7 it says, the parents may add their blessing with these or similar words. The wedding party may join them. The role of the parents is not to give the bride away or throw the party afterwards. The role of the parents may be as representatives of the family, but other members also may participate, is to share in the blessing. That's why they should stand there behind their children in the service. And this, the manual of the liturgy, I think, gives indications as to how one may arrange the wedding party. But bride and groom and parents behind them stand for the service. At the time of the blessing, the parents and family and others may face the bride and the groom. The parents may also write their own blessing. And Jan and I have been at weddings where this has been done, and it has been a very, very moving moment and occasion. Then after the blessings, the bride and groom stand, and the whole congregation stands with them for the prayers. You stand for the prayers. There are a number of options. Other intercessions may be offered. There may be prayers for all families throughout the world. And when there is no communion, the service concludes simply with the Lord's Prayer, blessing, Almighty God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, keep you in his light and truth and love now and forever. Amen. And out. This is, as you see, this is a very simple service. If it is celebrated within the context of the Holy Communion, a couple of things need to be said. The first is that the whole congregation is involved in the communion. You have gathered not for the wedding, but for the communion, and the wedding takes place within it. I guess, again, the most radical proposal I can make is that the service take place in the normal celebration of the Eucharist of the congregation, and that would be Sunday morning. It would mean then that the congregation gathers for its service. There may well be present there then a couple from the congregation who want to marry, their invited family and friends who are not necessarily a part of the congregation but who have joined it for that morning. And then the LBW is set up this way. The Eucharist has four parts to it. There's no doubt about the fact that two, the service of the word, and four, the meal, are the main parts of the service. The entrance rite is maybe a procession, but if you have the wedding on a Sunday morning, the entrance rite will not be this big procession of the bride and the groom. The bride and the groom will sit with family and friends, maybe in a special session, a section of the church, but the entrance rite will be the normal entrance ritual that the congregation has. The greeting, the Kyrie, the hymn, and the collect. Then comes the normal service of the word. Now then, I have a section that I've labeled transition because so many things fit into this. Hymn of the day, creed, prayers, and peace can be replaced by the marriage service. Even as on baptismal Sundays, they can be replaced by the baptismal service, or they can be replaced by an ordination, you see, or an installation. This transitional part is a module that you can just chonk in another occasion. And notice how the marriage service fits into that then. The marriage service does not begin on 202. It simply begins on 203, after the hymn of the day, which may very well be a marriage hymn, since the congregation is celebrating not only the marriage of John and Jean to each other, but of families generally. As baptism is a day for all of us to think of our baptism, so a marriage should be the occasion on a Sunday for all of us to think of family and home and the support that the community can give to sustaining families and marriages. Wouldn't that be better than St. Mother's Day? Anyway, let every marriage in the community become the occasion for family encouragement. And after the hymn of the day, which may well be a hymn on marriage or family, the minister then announces, "The Lord God in his goodness created us male and female," etc., etc. "John and Jean, if it is your intention to share with each other," and then they stand from wherever they are, and now you can have a procession of bride and groom and parents and friends to the altar for this brief ritual that I have described. Notice what is included in it. You've had the hymn of the day. You may follow the hymn of the day with the creed, but the creed is not a necessary part of this. The prayers are included on page 204, and the whole marriage rite ends with the peace, at which point bride and groom share the peace of the Lord with each other, with all of their friends and family who have come, and with anybody in the congregation who wants to share the peace of the Lord. It could practically be like it is at Holden. And indeed, you do not at this point even need then a big receiving line at the reception afterwards, because you have already had the receiving line right there in the context of the liturgy. What this does, you see, is take rituals that we have separated and scattered all over the place in our marriage and concentrate them within the context of the gathering of the congregation. The time for us to wish the peace of the Lord to the bride and the groom is right there in the liturgy. And you can even set this up so that the whole congregation can come forward and share in this greeting of peace for the newly married couple. And then the service continues with the offering, which may be the normal offering of the congregation, or it may be an offering designated by the bride and the groom for some special purpose that is a part of their own life together and their own ministry in the world. And when the service is over, the family and the friends and other invited guests can repair to whatever place they're going for more feasting and dancing and more celebration of the wedding. All of this can also be done on another day of the week. Besides the Sunday morning gathering of the congregation, it can also be done, let's say, on a Saturday. If you want to celebrate the Eucharist at the wedding, again, I would be very concerned that the congregation celebrates the Eucharist within which there is a wedding. Well, I want to stop at this point because I've probably stirred up enough problems and questions for us to talk about for a while. How do you react to all of this? What do you want to say to all of this?
I have a question about when I looked at the service, I was very pleased because it did away with a lot of the pagan stuff that's in SBH. But the thing that I was disappointed about is, assuming that it is the normal setting without the Eucharist, whether that's normal or abnormal, I suppose it's debatable, but I was a little disappointed that the congregation doesn't have more of a part. Now, I don't know necessarily how one could include them more, but I'd like to see that. Maybe leading the prayers, or perhaps even, I don't know exactly how it could be done, but I just had sort of a feeling that
yes,
they would end up being spectators again.
Well, there are congregational responses
mm-hmm.
throughout the service, and there is provision for some congregational singing. And I don't know how much more actually one could do to involve the congregation. Go ahead.
The congregation joining the prayers on page 204 instead of just the presiding minister.
They could, except that there are some blank spaces to be filled in, which might make it a little difficult. I would think that the prayer on page 204 at the bottom, "Gracious Father, you bless the family," that could be said by everyone. Might even be possible to have them join there. They are already joined in by the Amen, but I understand the point, but I don't know what more could be done. Mainly, what the authors of the LBW ritual intended was for marriage to be slid into this transitional thing, and therefore not to make the actual rite itself excessively long. It just doesn't have to be excessively long. The exchange of vows, of rings, the blessings and the prayers, and then you're just setting this whole thing into the context of the congregation's gathering. The purpose for it is, it seems to be, to provide the wedding, to provide the marriage with the support of a community. That's the function behind this. And that gives us then, in a sense, a radically different purpose for the occasion than the one that it has in American social life.
Well, the idea of doing it where they are makes a great deal of sense. It fits in very well then.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
That seems nice, but how often does a couple get married in the church that they are going to be members for the next few years, even? In our church, we have many people that just come and get married because it's a church. And it happens to be a nice, and the pastor marries them, not turning them away. But it's so often get married.
In our church, the pastor doesn't marry them.
Well, it may be a chance to give them the word and to involve them. It's an opening.
That's right.
Many clergy are now saying, I won't function at your marriage to each other unless you are willing to have some extended counseling.
Yeah, he counsels.
And think of yourselves, in some sense at least, as a part of a Christian community. See, the fact that we are authorized by civil law to function in the place of judges and justice of the peaces does not mean that we have to be marrying Sams available to
anybody. No, one of the proposals was that you do not fulfill that function. You go down to the legal and get your marriage certificate and do it there, and then get it consecrated by the presiding pastor.
But presiding minister means the ministry of the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult for me to see that there can be a ministry of the congregation when you're just sort of...
That's true, but it's very rarely happens.
I told you, I was not trying to describe reality. I feel often, as I said, as if I'm submitting to a gale. But I don't know what else to do except to lay out the vision.
Closer to the role that we have in church as baptism. When we go through baptism, because we are members and our children, then the congregation does take part in that and takes responsibility for that.
Mm-hmm. Please.
In Catholic marriages, I've been troubled by the fact that some could receive the sacrament and some couldn't. That seemed to me to be divisive at the very time when you're wanting unity. Now, this presents a problem for me in wedding ceremonies, is that so often you have people of other traditions present, many of whom do not, they could not participate conscientiously, or you even have non-believers present who may or may not know what's going on. And it just seems to me like there's possibilities of division rather than unity to try to incorporate the Eucharist at most of our weddings.
I hear what you're saying. Let me comment, first of all, on the Catholic experience. Catholics could right now have more intercommunion theologically than the bishops have so far allowed. So I think that we're in a sense a matter of time away from much more intercommunion on the part of weddings in Catholic contexts. I think that as far as Lutheran weddings are concerned, we ought to make clear, and we do in the whole Eucharistic ritual, what is happening here. If a marriage bulletin is printed, as I think is most appropriate, it can be stated in there what the understanding of the Lord's Supper is, and leave it up to the people who have gathered to decide whether or not they want to share in the ritual. Third point is, yes, I couldn't agree more that there are people who are probably today going to come to weddings where a Eucharist is celebrated and not know what's going on and not understand and in fact be outside. As far as I'm concerned, that's all right. We don't have to tailor our rituals to a kind of least common Christian, non-Christian denominator. And people who observe our rituals do so in a sense on their own. I mean, they are really on their own. I think of that on Easter Sunday in the former parish that we belong to. I knew that on Easter there were all kinds of people there who came because one or the other member of the family was a member of the congregation, but they were not. And the temptation, thought it was chipmunks. The temptation is, you know, on Easter Sunday, you think, well, since we have so many people here, we better not do all that we would normally do. And I thought to myself, no, they come at their own risk to a Christian gathering, and too bad if they don't understand it. Easter and Christmas are the worst times for non-Christians to be around anyway. I don't know why we make such an effort to get them all into church. It's the difference between being a cowboy and a shepherd, you know. The cowboy rounds up the herd once a year to see who's got his brand on. And but we're not, you know, cowboy has never been a metaphor for clergy. It's
shepherd is more like what we are. That's, you gather your sheep all the time. So I say weddings with non-Christians present, they come at their own risk. If they want to dance, if they want to be in the party, that's one thing. If they want to come to the place where the community gathers for the blessing of God, that's their problem. It's not ours. I don't know what else to say at that point. Please.
You talked about, you know, wedding cards and the history of it. What do you suggest to change that? I mean, do you say that they should not wear the traditional attire? Or?
No, they should wear the traditional attire, which is the best clothes you've got. The other is not, that's not my tradition. That's somebody else's tradition. That's Queen Elizabeth's tradition. That's the Duke of Edinburgh's tradition. It is not mine. You know,
it has become the tradition of the bride.
Possibly. But I would just simply do what people do in Europe. That is, you know, where we come from. We come from Scandinavia, from Germany. What do people wear at Scandinavian and German weddings? Their best clothes. That's what they wear. I think it's appropriate to make a special dress for your wedding. It can even be a white one, but one can make lovely white... I have no objection to that. One can make lovely white dresses that are not taken out of the 19th century English upper class, you know, that are not ball gowns or something like that. When we were in Germany traveling on the way to the Bayreuth Festival, we were just doing sleeping bags and hay mows wherever we could get a farmer to lend us one. And we stayed in Kitzingtal one Saturday night. Kitzingtal is in Schwaben, in the southern Germany. And the next morning, as we got up, we observed, we were brushing our teeth in the village fountain, and the church was right there. And the people were coming to church at about 7:30 in the morning in their tracht, the Kitzingtal dress. It was lovely, lovely clothing. And here, all of a sudden, we noticed a couple coming. They were, in fact, having a wedding that Sunday morning in the church, and the bride and the groom were wearing slightly more decorated tracht than everybody else. And it was just marvelous to behold. I still have pictures of all these people in their tracht and the women in the headdresses and so on. And they were escorting this couple into the church for the wedding on the Sunday morning. It was just marvelous. That's our tradition. That is the Lutheran tradition from Scandinavia, from Germany. You know, I don't know where this other stuff, I know where this other stuff came from, but I don't know how it got in. So I would just say, let us wear our best clothes, the best suit you've got, maybe decked out with a flower. That would be very nice. The best dress the bride can make for herself. Lovely, you know. And I have been at weddings where that's been done. And it's beautiful. I feel so good at a wedding like that, you know. Just sit there and grate at rented tuxedos and. Please. You didn't have. There was a hand back here. No.
I won't invite you to my daughter's wedding.
Probably could. I'm sorry. I know I'm stepping on toes and offending people, but. I'm really trying to hold out a vision and asking us maybe to think things through once again and to say, what are we up to with our rituals? What are we saying? What are we doing? Please.
Some of us come to the Lutheran Church, though, not as families in the Lutheran Church, and we come without traditions. And so therefore we kind of adopt traditions of the society, mm-hmm. and along with the white dresses and the veils and all of that. Our marriage was a very practical one. We did follow some of the traditions, but other ones we adapted to our own situation. And I think that those of us who don't have the strong Lutheran, German, or Scandinavian traditions are kind of holding on to the American tradition as mm-hmm, something mm-hmm. that we can identify with.
That's an appropriate word. I guess I get carried away. Mm-hmm. So I'm grateful for what you've said.
Pat?
Back to the service, one suggestion that we've used some is in the reading of the lessons, having friends with a couple read those.
Ah, yes.
In the congregation. And even some of the prayers, I think, could be done that way now.
Excellent. Excellent. Response to your, yeah, good. One more comment, and then we're going to quit.
I was just going to say that in regard to the LBW and what you've been saying, that I think it really offers an alternative. You know, I don't think that people really want to go through the English customs with the fancy tuxedos and ball dresses and all that. You know, I don't hear what the LBW says as saying that you can't do it or that it's wrong, but that this is just a refreshing alternative, a chance to get back to what our theology is really all about, and to do it very simply with you.
All right, that's a good word, and we didn't get around to burial today, which is probably just as well. I'll do that next Sunday morning. And pardon?
We won't have a lot to say about that.
We won't have a lot to say about our own. No, that is true. But I'm grateful for these opportunities to share, and Beanie and Gertrude now have coffee waiting us all up in Chalet 7. So let us adjourn to Chalet 7.